This is the Home Tech Podcast, show number 21 for April 14th, 2011. It's again a Thursday evening here at the Average Guy Studios, and I'm with some of my favorite guys doing podcasting, which is one of my favorite things to do. If you want to reach the show here at the Home Tech Podcast, you can reach me, podcast@theaverageguy.tv. And if you have questions or comments about what we do, we'd like to hear from you. This evening, I've got, like I said, I got my friends I like podcasting with, Andrew Morris. Andrew's from Melbourne, Australia, and has been on the show a while now. Andrew, welcome to the show. How are you doing?
Hi, Jim. Good. Really good. It's nice to be back in the saddle. I missed it last week. So.
Yeah. Well, we certainly understand. We were able to get you in right at the end of the show, and yep. And good to have you back again tonight. Christian and our traveling extraordinaire, Christian Johnson, he's over at biosmods.com and does all things BIOS. Christian, you're heading out of the country. What are you doing?
That's right, guys. I have the fortunate opportunity to attend a music tour with a chamber ensemble that I perform with locally. So we've spent about 2 years putting together a program of highly rehearsed music at a chamber quality level. So very excited to perform two live concerts in Cordoba and Buenos Aires, as well as two workshops with another Suzuki group down there. So very excited to be with them.
Very cool. It's always good to get out of the country, but be safe while you're down there.
Of course. Are we
going to try and sneak in live a little bit maybe while you're down there? Is that possible?
Unfortunately, I've made the decision to go cold turkey. And
wow.
For my health benefits, I am eliminating all sources of technology except for my camera. So
nice call.
Yeah.
All right. So we'll miss you next week.
Yeah. So I'm looking out for my health and education there. So.
Well, that's good. Well, we'll miss you next week, but I'm sure we'll be thinking about you. And a trip to Argentina sounds pretty good right now. It's probably starting to warm up down there. So,
well, al contraire, it's spring.
It'd be cooling
here,
so down. You're right.
Right.
You're right.
But it's still, their fall is high 70s. So compared to here where it's still like 40s, 50s, I'll take it. So
Yeah. Good. Good. Well, have a good trip down there. Tonight we're also joined by Mike Howard. Mike joined us a couple weeks back, and Mike, good to have you back on the podcast tonight.
Yeah, nice to be here, guys.
Yeah, it's good to have you, Mike. For folks who maybe didn't hear you the last time, give us a 1 minute intro to you. What do you do? Where are you from? That kind of stuff.
I'm from the Atlanta area. I go by Geek Accountant over in the Home Server Show, and the accountant part of me is what I do for a living. I'm a controller for a national restaurant company, and that accountant part has been keeping me really busy this week as we get ready for a board of the directors meeting and a officer meeting we do once a year.
Right. Right. And the geek side is we talked about the Super Router the last time you were on.
Super Router, yes.
And so I'm going to have you help me build one of those, I think, so we can get
great.
The Skype. I can get my Skype issues here. I host, both this show and the Home Server Show. And sometimes my boys like to, hog all the bandwidth. And I'd like to maybe cut them out a little bit.
Yeah, I've helped one of the guys over at the Home Server Show, one of the members, build one of his, and I'm helping another guy over there. So I'm sure we can do it.
Yeah, and I think I'll start a little bit at a time,
I think that's definitely the best way to go. Start simple.
Maybe take a piece of it and work it in, and then maybe add another piece to it, another piece, and maybe we'll talk about that on the show as we roll forward with it. So anyways, appreciate you being here tonight. We got a lot to talk about. Again, if you want to contact the show, if you've got ideas, questions for these guys, whatever, you can reach us. Send us an email here, podcast@theaverageguy.tv. We're also on Facebook. Just search for The Average Guy Network on Facebook, and you can follow all the updates there when I post the various shows that we do, both the fitness tech, the home tech, and the financial tech podcast. Those show up in that feed, and then you'll know they are there. And you, of course, can follow me on Twitter at Jay Collison, and oftentimes I tweet out when the show is starting. We do the show live each Thursday night, 7 p.m. Central, And if you want to join us, you can come to the Home Server Show. Home Server Show. Listen to me. TheAverageGuy.tv/live.
I know it.
Chris,
I
did it anyway. You said it. You set me up for it earlier when you said it. You put that in my mind. that's the danger of doing a couple podcasts is sometimes you forget which one you're on, and I'm sure Dave will enjoy the publicity. So good enough. All right. Hey, guys, I don't know about you, but over the last, week and a half, 2 weeks, I've had a run. We all have those network or those neighborhood network support, right? We're all kind of support for our friends and our neighbors and our family. I don't know about you guys, but at least I am. And recently, there's kind of been an outbreak of this Win7 Trojan virus. I don't even know what to call it. I didn't particularly look it up, but it's scareware, right? It pops in and says, "Hey, you have a virus. You should download the latest definition. And when you do that, it says you need to update and pay us money. And of course, you give them your credit card. And once you do that, it's dead." Now, I've taught my friends as soon as they see that, they call me, right? I don't you know, stop, don't do anything. This one particular virus, and I'm a guy, I run Microsoft Security Essentials, and when that has trouble, I run Malwarebytes to clean that stuff off. And 9 times out of 10, it works. But for whatever reason, both laptops, I could not get rid of this virus. It would absolutely not come off. I know, guys, do you have Andrew, what do you for antivirus, what do you kind of use? What's your regimen?
Yeah, I use Security Essentials as well. I guess in a similar vein, I've had a couple of virus issues this week as well for, again, weird viruses that just I don't know what they are or where they come from. And a couple of them, when I've put the executable file that they're dropping on the system into Google, they don't even come up in Google as being known. So to me, that's a bit of a worry that Google can't find a word.
Yeah,
you don't see that very often, a Google fail.
Right, right.
But yeah, I'm similar. I use Security Essentials, and then I use the McAfee Stinger for finding Trojans and rootkits. And then
if you pay for that?
No, that's a free utility. Okay. Off the McAfee website. So I'll throw a link to that in the show notes.
I'd be good.
Then if it's something like, say, Conficker or something like that, then we use the free tools that Symantec offer for ones like that, because they tend to be fairly quick to find them and get rid of them.
Okay.
And they do the job fairly well.
Christian, have you seen any increase among your friends or relatives?
The relatives a bit, not the friends as much, but I've noticed I don't remember – I went to a different orchestra I perform in. I went to their website, and I don't know if I had typed in the link wrong or what, but it suddenly took me to this. See, oh my gosh, it just did it again. So I typed in gbyo.net, right, which is the domain name for our orchestra.
Okay.
And when I go there, it just magically redirects me to this virus page that says it does one of those fake looking scanning your system now. You have a virus.
Right.
And it blows my mind, because as soon as I go back to the site a second time, it doesn't do it. Huh. But that site, I mean, there's no way it's something that's on that website, because I've gone to that website for years and it's fine. It's actually just one of these CMS sites. I mean, all it is text and picture. I don't understand. Maybe one of you guys have seen this, how that is interjecting, because I ran a full system scan with several stuff and it was nothing that was on my computer. So if it's not on my hard disk, not on my network, and the site's completely reputable and it's just text and images, I have no idea where this is coming from.
Well, and that's what I noticed too, is with my this virus completely wiped out Microsoft Security Essentials. It shut it down and wouldn't allow it to open. And then I went to Google and typed in Microsoft Security Essentials. It brought up the Security Essentials site. As soon as I clicked the link, it redirected me over to you know, one of these sites to purchase, you know, to purchase software or an infected page of some sort. Now, so there is some redirection going on right now out there, and I have a feeling that folks are getting redirected to the wrong place. Mike, have you seen in your stuff, have you seen anything?
Yeah, nothing on the PCs here. I'm at that site that Christian mentioned, and I'm fine there.
Okay.
I have, you know, I do have virus protection on all the PCs using Microsoft Security Essentials. But on top of that, my router has dual virus protection using, was that Casper Key or whatever? I could never say that right.
Yeah.
And then another one.
Kaspersky.
Yeah.
Kaspersky. Right. So I have seen that thing stop a few things recently, but you know, nothing unusual, no unusual activity.
Okay. Christian, what do you guys use?
The VeraSuite Security Essentials, and I personally deploy the host file protection on a lot of people's computers.
Yeah. Well, I have a feeling what happens is they're being, you know, they're that typical scareware that where the screen pops up and they click OK. And of course, once you do that, it deploys a packet to the PC.
Right.
And it doesn't matter what you have, it's going to get infected. And so I'm seeing a lot of that, and I don't know what's going on. It is a little scary that I had 3 in 1 week show up and two laptops and, you know, just kind of wiped out. I had to. Basically, I couldn't get the viruses off. My recommendation was to wipe them and let's start over and get them clean. Now, in a lot of cases, their OS was pretty whacked anyway, so it was a great opportunity to put something fresh on there.
Yeah, I take it they weren't using a Windows Home Server, so you couldn't restore.
No, they weren't. Andrew, were you going to say something?
Oh, I was going to say, are you guys seeing a lot of the social engineering scams going on at the moment, where someone calls up purporting to be from Microsoft, and when you sort of challenge them, they say, "Oh, well, we've performed a remote scan of your system, and we've noticed that you've got a virus, and please click on this link," and blah blah blah. And I had one of them the other night on my personal phone, and I'm going,
"Really?
How did you get my number from?" Because you know, my personal cell phone's a unlisted number.
Right.
And this guy goes, "Oh, well, we, you know, as part of Microsoft, we perform regular scans." I'm like, okay, well, and I've gone, okay, well, I'm running a Linux system. And there comes this, okay, well, we detected a virus on Linux.
Yeah.
And the guy goes, click.
Yeah.
And they hung up.
Yeah. That's pretty bold that they're calling you now on the phone.
Yeah, and it is really common in Australia at the moment. There are people getting called left, right, and center, and they go and download a bit of malware off the web from somewhere, which then prompts them for credit card details.
Right.
And people are getting suckered.
Well, I guess I want to say for the average guy, be on the alert. Make sure your antivirus stuff is up to date, and make sure that you're being careful from a web traffic standpoint about where you're going and what you're doing. It's just a reminder that, you know, there are scam artists out there that want to get a hold of your money. So double check the PCs in your environment. Make sure they're updated. Have a chat with the kids about clicking OK to everything.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and do what you can to lock it down. There are some ways around that. We may brush on those tonight. Mike, you asked me a second ago about a Windows Home Server. Of course, we come out of that home server environment, and you know, one of the ways to put the OS back on if I, you know, had a virus attack would be go back a couple days on my home server backups. But actually, I found a tool that if you're not a home server user, that really kind of makes it nice to move files over and then move them back. And it's actually for Windows 7 users and Vista users. It's already on their PC. It's called the Windows Easy Transfer. Now, it's really designed when you get a new PC to be able to move files and settings from one PC to the other. But I like to use it to quickly back up the settings and the files that are on that PC, blow it away or put the factory image back on, and then use that easy file transfer to move those files, you know, back on to the laptop. And it's software that already exists. I use an external hard drive to make it work, and the average guy can do it. Now, I guess the concern I have in that is I need to scan those files before I put them back on, because the virus could be hiding inside those files that I moved over. So I need to make sure I run a virus scan as I move that over. Have any of you guys used that Windows Easy Transfer program?
I have.
Before?
I Yeah, I have.
Yeah?
Yeah. Any... Well, I didn't have any problems. It worked great.
Okay. Did it –
Yeah, we used to
go ahead, Andrew.
Oh, no, I was going to say we used to use it as well. We used to use it for migrations, say, from Vista to Windows 7. I think there's another variant, the user state migration tool,
okay,
which does your user data and like all your desktop profile and favorites and the like.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. There's some tools out there to get it done that a lot of people don't even know about. So this easy Windows Easy Transfer is, you know, if you go to Start and all programs and accessories, and I think it's under System Tools. And there's the easy, it's just called Windows Easy Transfer. You can also, that one will work for you. I was going to say one of the things I forgot to mention when we were talking about antivirus, there's also a malicious, it's called the Microsoft Malware Removal Tool that Microsoft has an update to every single month that does a fairly decent job of removing viruses if you have it. And all you do is go down to Start, and in the command line or in the, what do they call that, the search bar, just type in MRT. I don't know if anybody have you guys ever used this before?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's how you get to the malware removal tool. So a pretty decent tool. I don't know, have you ever used it and it found anything?
I used it for the first time tonight after I saw it in the show notes, and it didn't find anything.
Well, that's a good thing. You know, I have not used it yet where it found something, but it would be one of those things that if you're having trouble, if you get a virus and you're having trouble getting it removed and it's shut off your antivirus stuff, you might want to try that MRT tool and see if it'll pull it off. Christian, have you had any experience with it?
Yeah, I've used it before. I can't remember if it actually picked up anything or not, but I know they've been doing that since probably late XP days, I'd say.
Yeah, it's been a while. Then they update it every single month. It shows up in your update. So,
but it's not like it's mostly rootkit and pretty heavy stuff that tries to remove. It's not for, you know, like the suspicious cookie file or anything
right.
like that.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, I think that one came to be around the Blaster Nachi days, didn't it? Because I remember we had a customer where they were running F-Secure, and I think it was one of those two viruses that it took out F-Secure. And when we started doing some investigation, this one was a really good one because we could deploy it using WSUS out into the environment and automatically execute it and. It was removing the virus, and you could deploy the patch at the same time. So, in the enterprise, it has been quite useful. Yeah,
yeah. It's one of those tools I think that Microsoft built to kind of address the security issues they were having at the time. And for whatever reason, there's a team at Microsoft that just keeps that thing up to date. So, I always tell folks my standard is if malware or if Security Essentials find something, immediately update and run Malwarebytes. And that's a pretty industrial strength cleaner. Now I'd forgotten about this MRT, so that's probably something I'll add in there as well and say, you know, just type in MRT or that's something you can walk somebody over the phone through really, really easy.
You
know, so
yeah, it's simple, isn't it? Start, run MRT, next.
Yep. It's kind of a wizard. So if you haven't tried that before, go out and take a peek at it. Some security tools to add to your toolbox. Okay, Andrew, you'd had here in the notes a Google a day. What's that about?
Yeah, I'm sort of finding some odd things around the internet that I think are kind of cool. So you know, it's not so much a tech thing, but there's a guy who's put together a website called agoogleaday.com, and it's kind of like an IQ test question, but that pops up at the bottom of a Google search window, but they prompt you to use Google search to work out the answer. So the question that I found the other day, which did my head in until I actually went through their cheat sheet on how to find it, was if you're a ferry passenger traveling from continental Europe to the country with twice as many sheep as people, in what town would you most likely dock? And it works you through it. So, and it's a bit of a nice way of teaching people how to use Google. Hmm. So their answer was, initially in Google, you'd search country with twice as many sheep as people, which they say will give you the answer as being Iceland. And then they say, next, search ferry to Iceland. And the next result comes up with a town that I've got no idea how to pronounce.
Seyosafor.
Yeah, yeah.
No, it's not right.
we wouldn't know if it was wrong.
It's something like that. You could easily sprain your tongue trying to pronounce it.
Yeah.
But it's one of those kind of cool things that for the average person who may, you know, like a grandparent or someone who doesn't really know how to use Google but has a fair degree of general knowledge, would be able to jump on this site when they've got nothing better to do and just learn how to use Google a bit better and use how to construct their search queries and then do second queries on top of it and the like. And there was another one about the US Constitution that came up. Apparently there's a misspelling in it, and they talk about how to find that, which I thought was kind of cool too. Yeah. Apparently Pennsylvania is not spelled correctly in the Constitution.
they didn't have spell check, huh?
Yeah.
Interesting.
So, yeah, it's just one of those little cool quirky sites that, you know, helps people on how to use something like Google a little bit better.
Yeah, the word Pennsylvania is spelled with a single N.
Yeah.
Interesting.
And are you guys all fancy with maximizing different ways of using, like, rather than just typing in keywords into Google, do you use like the plus and minus signs to, you know, associate which keywords you find more important and what order you want it to search in?
Mm-mm.
Yeah, no, I know there's
got into that either.
Yeah, you can do all sorts of like advanced search query syntaxes in your search that make it more accurate.
One of the things I like is the conversion tool built into Google. So if I want to convert miles to kilometers, or if I want to convert dollars to pounds, that works really well. Right in the search bar. That's one of the things I've used that for quite a bit.
And I use that a lot for temperature when you guys are talking about it's 98 degrees, and I sit there going, "What is 98 degrees?"
Yeah. So you just type in 98 degrees to Celsius, right?
Yeah, 98 degrees F in C, and it'll come up with whatever the answer is.
36.67.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah.
Nine fifths Celsius plus 32 degrees, boys. Break out the calculator.
Very good. Well, there's tons built in, and Google continues to just build in more and more and more. Into that and the Google property that exists out there. I mean, we use Google Docs for the show notes here, and I'll be honest with you, the Google Docs is so powerful from a collaboration standpoint. We can watch each other update the show notes in real time. So it's very impressive.
Isn't there a way in Google to have it search a specific website? So you type in your search and then you do something. I can't remember what it is, and it will search that specific website. You give it the website.
Right, yeah.
You all know that?
How do you do that, Christian?
I know, like, for what I have going for BIOS mods, they have a section in, I think it's, there's one of the webmaster tools that they have. It's AdSense, where you can set up a search bar that will actually take your site, and it gives you a custom search bar that allows you to embed it anywhere you want in your site, and then you can use that as your actual search bar. That way you get that AdSense for the text on top and the side. So that's how you specifically search it. But I know if you type into regular Google, I believe you have to do site colon and then the address and then whatever else, it'll do it that way and just search that site.
Yeah, I think go ahead, I thought you typed in your search then colon and then the website.
Yeah, well, I know site colon is used when it's just that's the only thing you want to bring up the main pages for that particular site. So let's see what it does.
I can't remember how to do it now.
Right. See, if I do site colon theaverageguy.tv. It brings up the top pages for the average guy. And then let's see if I do like a search key. So now I believe if I go ahead and do, let's say I do multipoint. Right. So if I do site colon theaverageguy.tv and then my keyword after, it brings up the search result right away.
Interesting.
So I did my test keyword was bringing up the multipoint article John did a while back. Site colon theaverageguy.tv and then multipoint and bang, there it is.
Cool.
Wow, that's pretty cool. I did not know that.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's like custom search within that site, Ben.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah. Right.
From the Google website.
Right, from the Google website. Yeah, that's pretty cool.
But Google needs to know about your site to have indexed it somehow, doesn't it?
Right. Well, I mean, it's pretty – even if you don't submit your site to Google, it does a pretty good job of automating that.
Finding it.
Right, yeah. So, like, if you went to BiosMods, you'd see right at the top of the forums, it's got custom Google search, and when you type in those keywords, it just only brings up results from that site.
Yeah, and when you're on the Google page, right next to where you would key something in, there's an advanced search. And if you click that, then in the upper right-hand corner is advanced search tips. And then that gives you several tips, including the site-specific one we just talked about.
So including excluding some of the keywords you don't want and filtering. So
wow, that's a nice how to.
So I mean, like people use Google all the time, but they don't always realize how much more powerful it can be than what they're using it for.
Right.
Yeah.
So they've got a phrase search between quotes, right? Search within a specific website. That's what we just did. Site colon terms you want to exclude is the minus. Fill in the blank is the star. Search exactly as is the plus sign, and you can use the OR operator in there.
Right.
San Francisco Giants 2004 or 2005, and it will give you the results about either one of these years, one or the other. Interesting. Well, that's kind of cool. I had no idea.
This is funky. I just used some keywords to search for my parents' business, which they run a bed and breakfast out of Melbourne, and I came up with a Japanese website that's referring to them in an ad on a side banner.
Really?
Wow.
I think I got something wrong here.
Well, hopefully you're not driving right now on the road if you're listening and you're not trying to Google on your phone these things that we're saying. Pull off to the side. Yeah, not very good, Andrew. That's interesting. I always knew there were some advanced search capabilities within Google. But I'll be honest with you, I get real lazy with it. I go out, especially with Instant, right? And you just start typing stuff in, and that Instant really just guides you. Especially if you're a bad speller like me, that the Instant just goes out there and finds it. For you and helps you get it. Have you ever gone out and put your name in and then says is? And
Google bashing.
It's an interesting exercise maybe in who you are. So anyways, I heard Laporte talking about that this week, so I went out and did it. When I put Jim Collison is, I don't get any instant results.
Yeah, me neither.
Yeah, so I'm not that popular.
I do, but they're not for me. There's a musician called Andrew Morris. He's everywhere.
Apparently, there's quite a few Mike Howards out there too.
Yeah, that would seem pretty common. I bet. It must have said Christian Johnson is smart. Is that the?
Ha.
All right. Enough.
It looks like Christian Johnson's artwork showing me up right now. So.
Yeah, I'm sure there's a million Christian Johnsons out there as well.
Not as cool as the real deal, but
no,
that's okay.
No, we don't like them as much as we like you. Christian, what do you got for Christian's Corner?
So, yeah, I thought I would start off. One of the big tech projects I had this week with going on tour is I was pretty much harangued for a week about setting up a Silverlight photo gallery that they could just, drag and drop photos into and have, slideshow presentation full screen, and then that turned into having a blog ready, and that turned into being able to stream video. Probably the hardest part of that challenge, I actually did write a small program that automates adding the photos to the gallery. And I also did some other stuff with JavaScript. But I'd say the hardest part of it was finding something within the WordPress blog that I set up that allowed for video streaming that actually worked halfway decent. And the best result I came up with was a Flow Player plugin, which that's the one of those common Flash-based video programs that are out there now, has been used for, it works for MP4 and FLV, and that's what I had the most success with. But besides, let's exclude home server, what's the easiest way for the average guy to share videos with his family?
YouTube.
That's true.
Yeah. Or Facebook.
Yeah, Facebook is – the thing I don't like about Facebook, though, Mike, is that you embed those in there, and then you can't – I think you have more trouble sharing those than you do on Facebook. I mean on YouTube.
Well, like okay. On YouTube, if you want to set a family video to private, then you have to invite everyone in your group that you want to see it.
No, very true. Very true. You know, Facebook takes care of that for you.
Yeah, because like they told me the same thing. You know, why can't we just embed YouTube videos? And I told them, well, if you want to uphold your privacy policy and you don't feel like sending out emails every time you upload a video to be invited, then
right,
you know.
Does Facebook – do you run into the same problem with Facebook?
Well, with Facebook, I'm not sure, but there you'd have to create a group and people would have to join the group. I mean, again, it's just – it's like –
yeah, the only videos we're sharing are the ones we take with our Android phone, and the kids do it too, and we post them on Facebook. So no big production value there.
Right. So yeah, I guess that was my my quick question for you guys.
Yeah.
So moving forward, the deal of the week, purchased this for my cousin's upcoming graduation, is a smoking refurbished deal on a Intel iCore 5 laptop. It's a refurbished Asus with the Intel i5 460, 2.5 gigs, got the quad core, the 4 gigs of memory, 640 gig hard drive.
Bless you.
The, HD.
Twice.
Oh, geez. the HD graphics. I mean, it's got everything. Windows 7, $500. But I mean, for $500, that's a pretty smoking laptop.
Now, Christian, you're kind of an Asus fanboy, aren't you?
Yeah, well, everyone knows never I will buy HP again. So Asus is, to
sorry,
be honest
Andrew.
With you, to be honest with you, Asus
sorry,
has
I'm just
really
seeing
been
you crying.
Asus has only really been the consistent performer in OEMs. You know, some of these OEMs have good days, bad days, and Asus just always puts out rock solid stuff that there's support for. If it doesn't work, they make it work, and they don't give excuses for why it doesn't work. And for a price like that, you know, who wouldn't? I mean, that's the perfect graduation laptop or wedding laptop or whatever it may be, you know?
No, I'm taking a peek at it now. It looks pretty good. $500 bucks for an i5. That's a pretty good deal.
Yeah,
it is a good deal.
It's an awesome deal.
Yeah, 15.6-inch screen. And integrated graphics, HD graphics. So it's got an HDMI out, right?
Yes.
Yeah. That's pretty sweet looking. You'll drop that in the show notes, I take it?
Right. And also, moving on to our Windows 7 tweak for the week. Now, this is more of a cool thing to do on a rainy day than actually speeding up your computer. But I was able to remote desktop my PC, which just has one 24-inch monitor, to my dad's workstation, which has three triple monitors running on his ATI graphics card. And normally, if you just log in a remote desktop, it only extends it to one of the monitors and doesn't use the other two. But using a little trick, by opening up remote desktop from your command prompt. So getting to that System32 folder, and I believe it's MTSC EXE or something similar to that. That's the main EXE for remote desktop. If you add the switch /multimon, it will actually extend it to however many displays you had. So I was able to successfully control my box, which has one monitor, to a computer that had three. And that was actually way more productive than just having that one window.
Did it? What That's did it look like on the awesome. Monitor, Christian? So you saw all three of his monitors on your one, or?
No. I went down there and took remote desktop, took remote control of my computer.
Gotcha.
So I was no longer limited to having my one monitor workspace. Right. I was able to bring my computer basically to another workstation that had three monitors and extend it across.
Nice.
Yeah. Christian, one of the things I've done, maybe this is the same thing, is when I remote into some of my VMs, I have remote desktop shortcuts on my desktop here to remote into any of them. And then I just go in and edit them, and there's a switch on there's a setting on the display thing that says use all of my monitors for the remote session. And I click that. I don't generally use it, but I have used it in the past to spread something over both of my monitors.
Well, yeah, it's a good tweak. I'll have to have you post that in the notes. But yeah, I found the command line thing. I couldn't find it in the regular when it's linked to the desktop, but just the regular when you open up the remote desktop to connect to a client wasn't there in any of the advanced settings. So I was kind of glad I got that working.
That's pretty cool. So does your dad ever get to use his computer again?
Yeah, once in a while. three 24-inch monitors is pretty hard to go back to.
Yeah, so wait a minute. Got one and he has three. So what's wrong with that picture, Christian?
The way my desk is built, it's large enough for three monitors if I took like the shelving above it off. So
yeah, all right. He's not holding you back, right? He's not holding the man down.
No. Right. He wants to replace his 324 inches with 330 inches and offload the 24 inches to me.
Nice.
Oh, there you go. Yeah. Do you guys use any kind of monitor arms for your monitors?
No,
just a regular stand.
No, just regular. But actually, those monitors were a deal too. Those are rebranded HP, those like $500 24-inch HP monitors. They had rebranded ones from some large global company that had rebranded ones that they were selling. Picked up a $500 monitor for like $190, free shipping and everything.
Wow.
Yep.
Yeah, that's a nice deal.
Worth $500 retail, yeah.
Right. Wow. That's the way to get it. Mike, do you use any kind of monitor mounts or?
You know, I just bought two of them, one for my monitor, one of my second monitors, and one for the wife's. And they're sitting right here waiting for me to install.
How much were they?
I was just looking for that on Amazon. I think it was $60 a piece.
Yeah, that's been my problem with them a little bit. Some of them can get kind of pricey.
Yeah, and those only handle up to a 22-inch monitor. You know, the one I want for my 24-inch, I think that one was 120.
Yeah. Yeah, it's tough because, you know, you especially if you get a good deal on the monitor, and then you're almost paying twice that to mount the thing.
Yeah.
And so it's I go back and forth. For now, I just leave it on my stand.
Well, I figure I would buy these. They're a little bit cheaper, and if they're just really awesome, I really love it, then I'll look into buying one for me.
Yeah, very cool. Excellent. What else you got, Christian?
So going to some Microsoft shenanigans.
You like to kind of point those out, don't you?
Yeah, it's my favorite part of the day. I was doing some looking around, and the first thing, Windows 8 has had its first leak. So we're going to start seeing news about that and some of the new features like I talked about with the Ribbon integration. Which I'm mostly excited about that. I really want to see be put to good use. And the second one is they're already talking. There's already a scheduled time frame for Internet Explorer 10. There's already work being put towards it, and there's already developers working on it. So some of the things that are being developed in the IE 10 include HTML6, and CSS4. So what I'm intrigued about is the fact that for IE6 through IE8, it was HTML4 and CSS2 2.1. And now just in two browser releases, we've upgraded to two whole new standards of HTML. I thought HTML 5 would live, have as long as a lifespan as HTML 4 did, but they're going right on with having a HTML 6 rolled out with CSS 4. So I'm not really sure where the other browsers stand in terms of even HTML 5 support, but I haven't really seen any specifications indicating that HTML 6 is going to be widely adopted yet. So I'm interested to see these new technologies they continue to integrate into Explorer. But at the same token, I'd like to see them clean up some of the issues I still have with IE9, primarily not having all my links work the way they should and having all the pages render 100%. So I just thought it was kind of interesting that they're starting to push the release much earlier than they normally do. But then again, you have to keep in mind that Firefox, Chrome, and Opera, they're all releasing new versions every 6 months to a year now. So I think Microsoft's trying to come up to that release schedule. But at the same time, they realize that one thing that's more unique to their situation is they have to worry about enterprise clients and compatibility with their applications. So they're trying to ensure that these new timelines don't conflict with business solutions and compatibility. So
yeah, that's the real truth. I mean, there's still some organizations that are struggling to get rid of IE6.
Right.
So they do got to make sure that compatibility is there. And I think, you know, I applaud Microsoft for getting a more routine release schedule for their browsers, especially at the enterprise level. It does give us enterprise folks a little more predictability on what's moving forward. And, you know, I think HTML5 is a very moving target. Certainly the standard is out there, but it is changing rapidly. Christian, I don't know, my thought on 6, I haven't really even heard much talk around that, but it's probably just the next version of 5 as opposed to being a complete rewrite. I mean, right. 4 and 5 are pretty different, and I think IE9 and IE10 are going to be pretty similar.
Yeah,
Microsoft probably won't go through the whole rewrite like they did from 8 to 9. So, but yeah, I applaud them for getting on a release schedule. I mean, that from an enterprise perspective, that does make it a lot easier for us folks to deploy that those kind of browsers out to the enterprise. Andrew, you'd been bashing IE 9.
I'm kicking it now.
Yeah. I'll be honest, I haven't even upgraded yet. I'm holding off. I'm not going to put it on my PC maybe for a couple more months.
Yeah, the more I use it, the less I like it at the moment. I like the fact that they've minimized the interface down, but you and I had a quick discussion yesterday on Skype about the latest Skype upgrade to 5.3, and Skype 5.3 doesn't play nice on a 64-bit Windows 7 operating system with IE9 installed.
Okay.
So when you start it up, you get a JavaScript error. So I'm just looking at it going, roll that machine back to IE8.
What version of Skype is that?
5.3.
No, we'd had some Skype issues tonight. I'm still on 5.1, so I'm wondering if I need to upgrade. But are you saying if I go to 5.3, it may break it on 64-bit?
5.3 with 64-bit if you put it in compatibility mode,
okay,
which means you can then minimize Skype back down to the taskbar rather than have it sitting on Windows 7 down with all your the launcher bar down in there when it's closed. You need to turn off compatibility mode and then you can minimize it back down to the taskbar, because I like my launcher bar to be fairly clear of clutter.
Okay. All right.
So that was what that one was. So there's a fix for that. But yeah, with IE9 installed, when Skype launches, when it goes to load the little cloud pictures to show whether people are online or away or busy or on a call or whatever, it seems that it must use JavaScript to pull that via IE or whatever the default browser is, because the couple of machines I've seen with IE9 and Skype on them, as soon as we did the upgrade, they get a JavaScript error.
Hmm.
And when we put it back to IE8, the problem goes away.
Interesting. Well, I'll have to take a peek at my Skype. Mike, what version of Skype are you running at this point? Christian, look at yours too. I'm kind of interested in
5.1.59.112. Okay.
So you're a higher version than me at this point. Christian, what are you running? He's checking. Andrew, are you running? So you're running 5.3, right?
I'm running 5.1.0.112.
Oh, that's
because I went back.
Okay, that's the one I'm running. Yeah. Well, Christian, what do you got?
Sorry, no, ignore me.
Oh, okay. You're taking the headset up. Our video's not working tonight, so we're having some trouble seeing each other, which this reminds me how valuable the video is, you know, in these conversations, because typically I can see you guys, and it makes it a little easier to run the podcast. Well, anyways, let's wrap up the IE9 conversation there. I think I'm going to check in to maybe upgrade my Skype. Maybe that will help, you know, in what we're going through. Christian, you got anything else?
Yeah, have they been running those updates automatically for Skype?
No.
Auto upgrade to 5.3?
No, I don't think so, because it hasn't happened for me.
Yeah.
I had to go get mine. The first time I came on the show, Jim, you asked me to go update, and that's what it got.
That's what it gave you. So there must be a more recent upgrade, although it sounds like it's going to upgrade me to 5.3 if I go out there now.
Okay.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I may try that and see how that – since I don't – have any other podcasts this weekend, I might give that a shot and see if maybe there's a fix. I know on the Mac, version 5 has just been an utter disaster. And so it's really struggled in that environment. So Skype is a love-hate relationship for a lot of us folks. It's by far the best way to do these kinds of things, but it sure has its issues at times.
Yeah, it works beautifully some days, and then other days it just doesn't.
Yeah, you know, Andrew, when you said beautifully, that stretched out in only the way Skype can do.
Yep.
That was so nice. All right, Christian, thanks for that stuff on Christian's Corner. Mike, I know you want to spend a little bit of time talking about visualization and that – or, I'm sorry, virtualization. I do business intelligence visualizations at work, so sorry for the confusion there. The virtualization is one of those topics that I think you've either done it and you've done a lot of it, or maybe you haven't done any of it. There's a lot of different options out there. Why don't you kind of talk through a little bit from your experience and give us a quick primer on what's available from a virtualization standpoint.
And my plan with this was to keep it somewhat simple, but
yeah,
I can only go so complicated on this.
Yeah. Topic. No, I think it's a good overview. You got it laid out nicely.
Yeah. And, you know, basically it comes down to two, there's more, but just two main, I don't know what that is.
That's Christian.
Oh, two main types of virtualization. A bare metal one where you install this lightweight operating system right onto the hardware, and it is the operating system. And then you load on all your virtual machines on top of that. That's where you do run a server at the house or something like that. It's a little more complicated. And then there's the kind where you have a host operating system. So you're running Windows, you're running Linux, whatever you're running. And then you have a virtual program, something like VirtualBox, running on your computer just like any other program that you have on there. And then that program, VirtualBox in this case, allows you to install operating systems inside of that and run them as if they – in that program, the operating system you run on VirtualBox thinks it's in its own environment. Where I got into that is I was always Linux curious, but I hated the dual boot option where you would install both operating systems on one drive and boot up into each one of them. And then I came across VirtualBox, which just I think it's virtualbox.org. And you just download it. It's anybody can do that. You can just download it, install it. It's very easy to install. And then you just need the ISO, the disk image, or the disk itself. And you can install an operating system inside of VirtualBox.
Yeah, and that's been my favorite virtualization option that's out there is VirtualBox. Now owned by Oracle. No surprise there. They bought that with that. I think that was a Sun product that got with the Sun acquisition.
And at some point, I think at some point I had something like 20 different operating systems I had loaded into VirtualBox. Of course, not all running at the same time.
Right.
But, I'd gotten crazy and tried all kind of different things desktop BSD, Kubuntu, Ubuntu, all these different things
right.
I was able to try. And you can even do a type with VirtualBox where it's the full screen. So it really kind of just blends into your operating system that you have. You sometimes you don't even notice it's there, but it's there running in the background. And I would use it to browse, use Ubuntu to browse the web or do something like that. And then where it came in handy was when I switched all of us over to Windows 7. We were all on XP here at the house. The first thing my wife starts complaining about is different. This doesn't work. That doesn't work. And it really was working fine. It was just that it's different.
Right.
So I had her old disk, and I used a program called, I think it was Disk2VHD, where I took her old hard drive and converted that hard drive into a virtual machine. And then had that virtual machine loaded into VirtualBox on her computer.
Ah.
And I told her, you know what? You don't like how Windows 7 is working. As to ease the transition, just boot up this thing, and there's your entire old system.
That's a great idea.
And she used that for a little while, but quickly figured out that Windows 7 was the better way to go. And I still use it. I'm sorry.
Oh no! When you did that, did you have all your files sitting on a file server or your Unraid appliance, or how did you manage that so that anything that changed on that XP desktop that was virtualized, you didn't then run the risk of losing the files?
One of the things I try to do when I upgrade a computer to a new operating system like this is I put a new hard drive in there. Uh-huh. So the old hard drive that had Windows XP on it was sitting there unused, and I did that. I'd like to do that until I feel really comfortable with the new operating system is doing fine and we've got everything we needed to off that thing. And so I just had the hard drive sitting there, and I have a little USB dock thing that I just plugged it into and ran that disk to VHD, and it turns that entire disk into a virtual machine.
Okay, cool.
So Mike, talk a little bit about, so you run that program on the on the XP box itself, right?
No, you would run that. I guess you could. I ran it on my Windows 7 machine, on my machine.
Okay.
Just plugged her old hard drive.
Oh, gotcha.
Into my USB dock.
Gotcha.
And then converted it over.
Oh, that's a great idea.
And the beauty about a virtual machine is pretty much what's happening with that virtual machine is the virtual software, like VirtualBox, is emulating is all the hardware.
Right.
So you can actually move that virtual machine from one PC to the next, and for the most part, it will go just fine. I created a virtual Windows XP on my machine and just copied across the network to my son's machine, and then he used it on his.
Yeah, it's great.
I think he had an issue with maybe the network card that we had to do something there. But
I have found with VirtualBox, you need to set that network card just right to get it to do what you want it to do. But interestingly enough, the link that you put in here points over to a How to Geek article written by Mystic Geek Brian Burgess, who used to do the podcast with us. So Brian outlined that nicely for us, and in that article, we'll put that link in the show notes.
Go ahead. I think if you're the average guy, trying something like VirtualBox is just so easy that you might as well give it a try.
Yeah. I don't disagree with you. I think it's the best place to start if you've never done any kind of virtualization before.
The other thing I'm starting to do is anything I download that I wonder, I don't know if I really want this program to install on my computer. A lot of times you download something, you figure out later you don't like it, you delete it. So sometimes I will download those into a virtual machine. If they're junk, I just delete them out of the virtual machine.
Yeah. Yeah.
My main machine. Another thing is I have one of my own websites that I'd like to see it as a guest while I'm also working on it. So I have the virtual machine logged in as a guest, and then I'm on my main machine on one monitor, working on the thing.
Yeah. What kind of box do you have? I mean, what kind of processor are you using?
I'm using a box. Quad core AMD Phenom 3.2 gigahertz and with 8 gig of RAM. And that, as you get into these virtual machines, the RAM does become pretty important. You want as much RAM as you can get. If you're running a 2 gig system, 32-bit Windows, that's going to be too little. You're going to want more RAM than that.
Yeah. Yeah. My 4 minimum for me, even running one virtual box. So if I have. If I'm running it on Windows 7 and I'm creating a Windows 7 virtual image,
Yeah.
Four is the minimum for me. I give two gig to it, and it pretty much consumes most of my RAM resources at that point.
I have, you know, like I said, 8 gig, and I am always bumping up against that 8 gig.
Really?
But, yeah, I think, you know, maybe it's just my crazy usage pattern, because I'm looking right now, I got 40 tabs open in Chrome.
Oh, good heavens.
I also have Photoshop open, Lightroom open, and Quicken. So
yeah,
I need to close some of those things.
Well, it's easy to do that in Chrome, and I find after doing these shows, you know, we talk about so many links. By the end of the show, I've got, you know, 20 or so tabs across the top. So that's not hard to do. You know, with Chrome, I've also found if I leave that open for long periods of time, the performance begins to degrade some in Chrome. And I find I've got to almost reboot Chrome from time to time to get that performance back. I mean, it's just barely noticeable, but it is – I'm not sure if it's a great idea to leave Chrome open all the time with all those tabs taking all that memory.
I think I had it open for one stage for about 40 days with about up to 70 odd tabs in it.
Really?
I was doing a whole bunch of research on fish tank layouts for a planted tank.
Okay.
And I just didn't want to close them down because I didn't want to have to go back into all the links that I'd followed in these forums.
Right.
To come back back. And I think there was about four upgrades to Chrome in the meantime. But the nice thing with Chrome is if you do an upgrade, when it does its restart, it saves all its tabs, and the next time it opens up, they all come back.
Well, so it was restarting, though. It was restarting Chrome in the midst of all that, right?
Yeah. But one thing I have found, though, is if you do find Chrome's starting to run like that, if you go into Task Manager and kill off the primary instance of Chrome running and then restart it, it'll say, oops, it crashed. Do you want to open up tabs again?
Okay.
That's a good tip. That's why I don't like to get rid of my tabs. I find all these sites I want to save. I really don't want to bookmark them, but I hate to close it down.
Right.
Yeah.
Rightly
separation
so.
Thing.
Yeah, right.
Separation
so.
Anxiety, I call it.
And right now I'm running a Windows XP VM through VirtualBox because at work I have a Windows XP machine. I have Office 2010, but most of the folks there have Office 2003. So I have Office 2003 loaded in its virtual machine. And as we, you know, doing some Excel training or anything like that, I can go over into that virtual machine and use those same things I use at work.
It's free and it works really well for those kinds of things. Mike, what do you think is your most common VM? I mean, what do you think you use the most?
Through VirtualBox?
Yeah. I mean, what do you find yourself going back to over and over and over again?
The funny thing is the one that's always open is Windows XP.
Okay.
For a long time there, I was running Ubuntu and then an offshoot of Ubuntu called PinGuy. And there's something – Linux drives me nuts, but there's something about Linux that keeps bringing me back that I keep wanting to play with it. And that's a great way to do it is through, you know, VirtualBox. Not only is VirtualBox free, but Ubuntu is free,
right?
All free software.
Right. And have you messed around with the bare metal?
I have three bare metal servers. I have Hyper-V. Yeah, in that case, actually – in that case, I'm running the full OS 2008 with Hyper-V, and I had on that one I have, home server, both current version and the previous version, and some Windows 7 VMs, and I think one of the Windows 7 VMs I use is like our media one. It runs PlayOn, it runs TiVo to go software, all that stuff. And then I have two Zen servers, which are also bare metal servers. One of them runs the SuperRouter. And then the other one is just for testing anything non-Windows. I've never had great luck loading a Linux or non-Windows system onto Hyper-V. So I generally just load those on the Zen server, which works just great. And Zen server is free also.
Is
the version I use.
Okay. And is Hyper-V free, or is that in a TechNet type subscription?
No, it's free.
Okay.
Yeah, there's two versions. The free version is the bare metal, you know, just the Hyper-V server. There's another one that comes as part of Server 2008 R2. And that, of course, is not free.
Right. Okay.
And then even with Zen Server, there's paid versions. And, you know, we're talking about these two, but as we get into bare metals, the Zen server, the Hyper-V, but the leader, of course, is VMware, the ESXi and all that. I had issues with my hardware with it. Not, it's a little more picky with the hardware and couldn't get it to load on my hardware, and that's where I went into Zen server.
Yeah, I think that's where I think the differentiator is, that ESXi is a little bit more enterprise strength, and I think you need the enterprise level hardware to get the straight out of the box compatibility.
Yeah, and it is the market leader. It's the, from what I understand, it's the market leader out there and the industry standard.
Yeah, very much so. Look, we use a little bit of Hyper-V, but the Hyper-V stuff's a bit of a pig in comparison to ESXi. When you start looking at, you know, we've got say 30 machines sitting in a cluster.
Yeah.
ESXi just manages it beautifully. You turn on the function called what's it called? VMotion. Dynamic.
Yeah, VMotion, yeah. And dynamic memory.
Yeah, and that's awesome. And, you know, if you start running out of resources on one of your nodes in maybe two or three, in say maybe a two or three node cluster, it just transparently moves it somewhere else where there's more resources for it. And the end user doesn't see it. And it's just awesome for downtime and maintenance. And yeah.
And, you know, this is a little beyond the average guy, but, you know, I have the two Zen servers, and one I'm running just the router software. But I've been having recently, I think I'm having a disk problem, and I had a problem with Untangle. So I just moved it off onto my other Zen server, and I'm running it there doing some tests to figure out what's wrong. And then if I fix it, or I reinstall it and then move it back.
Yeah, it's handy.
It is incredible.
Yeah, that is handy.
Virtualization, even with VirtualBox, you know, seems like magic to me almost.
Yeah, it is very cool. You know, you mentioned the average guy. Probably some of these solutions, they're not too much for the average tech guy. I mean, so, you know, if you're a tech guy out there and you know, you're messing around with the stuff, I've loaded Zen Server and Hyper-V before, and I'm not tech savvy from a server perspective, but you can get those up and running and working. You know, one of the guys, I was on a forums, and he was like, okay, I got Hyper-V up and running. Now what? You know? And, you know, what do I do now? So I'm getting the server. I don't think getting the server running sometimes is the hard part. It's getting the images going and installed on some of those solutions that gets a little more difficult.
And deciding why you want to do this in the first place.
Right. Yeah. Andrew?
Very much so. I think for the average guy, given that most people are now running Windows 7 too, there's the XP mode virtualization that's built right into as a Microsoft offering, and it's a replacement for their old virtual PC product, which was also free. But if you've got a legitimate Windows 7 license, you get a free license for XP Desktop to run within that virtual machine.
You know, I've never used that. I'll be honest with you. I don't. I'm trying to leave XP in the dust.
Mm. Yeah. So I use it all. I use it all day, every day at work, because the remote access solution for the client that I'm supporting at the moment only runs on XP or Vista.
Okay.
And I don't want. And I don't want to run Vista on my desktop.
Yeah.
And I certainly don't want to go back to XP. So I've got a Microsoft VM that's got 2 gig of RAM allocated to it. And it sits on my right-hand monitor, and it's just like having two PCs on the one keyboard, and it's really, really handy.
Yeah, that would be. I guess, yeah, I haven't – I've been trying to, like I said, leave XP in the dust and never go back to it again, ever. But certainly, I know in some enterprise environments you can't – you just can't get away with that.
Yeah, you know? And look, eventually the technology stack will catch up with where people – are moving with the desktop, but it's just a matter of time, and it's money.
Yeah. Well, and Mike, you'd put in the notes here that Windows 7 has finally overtaken Windows XP from a market share perspective.
Yeah, Vista never did that.
No, and thank God it didn't. You know, I was I was reinstalling Vista for a friend today, and it literally – so I was on a laptop. It's a Celeron processor, so it's probably 2 or 3 years old. And I started that, I went all the way back. This must have been the first version of Vista ever made. And so I installed it from the recovery section on the hard drive and then let updates run overnight. and then I took it to work with me and put it on my desk, and from time to time I'd look at it. And there was about 60 updates before Service Pack 1 would install. And then Service Pack 1 took probably an hour or half hour to install. And then there were probably another 65 or 70 updates before Service Pack 2 would install. And then, you know, so you install Service Pack 2. Somewhere in there, IE8 came in and wanted to install itself. Literally, I mean, I think I'm finally to the point this evening. One of the things I'll do after the show is fire that thing up and see if it's got all its updates. Literally took me all day.
That's nasty.
To get that up, to get a Vista. So, yeah, if I'd known that, and I should have known that, I probably would have said, you guys need to go buy a Windows 7, install this.
Oh, yeah.
You know? I never ran Vista on any of our PCs here.
Yeah, I did. And post-Service Pack 2, it's okay. Yeah. And it actually works pretty well. And I used Ultimate for a long time, and it was fine. You know, it worked. Or maybe I should say post-Service Pack 1, it worked just fine. So
yeah, I ran Vista from the release candidate all the way through to when the release candidate 2 for Windows 7 came out, both at home and enterprise level. And I thought Vista was pretty good up until probably when they hit about 40 hotfixes. Around about when they hit the 40th, 50th hotfix in Vista Service Pack 0, I think it really started to bog down.
Mm.
And I think that's where it started getting its reputation as being a horrid operating system.
Thank God for Windows 7.
Oh, yes. Yeah. So much better. Yeah,
my God. I mean, I kind of saved the OS, I think, in a lot of ways. And we've just made the jump where I work. We've just made the jump complete from the enterprise perspective to Windows 7. And that went fairly smoothly for us. And a lot of folks like it. And, you know, ironically, in Windows 7, the two features that I would show people the most and I would get the biggest wow factor out of was sticky notes. I don't know if you guys have used sticky notes in Windows 7 yet, but it's basically just Post-it notes for your desktop, right? They don't do much. You can't save them, but people love them. And they like that. And the other is the snipping tool.
How good is that?
You know, two little applications that probably took, you know, 5 hours, somebody at Microsoft 5 hours to develop. you know, and I say that sarcastically, but I've told folks, you know, the task manager inside of Outlook probably got 100,000 hours worth of development to get it, you know, right with the prioritizations and the check marks and all the different options that you have. And I find people keeping their task lists in sticky notes, you know?
Yeah, but whatever works, hey?
No, that's what I'm saying. I mean, for some people, simpler is just better. And so it doesn't, you know, you don't have to always have the most powerful, most expensive option from a productivity standpoint. Sometimes those simple little tools are easy.
Go ahead. Oh, Jim, you had said you guys just moved over to Windows 7 at your office.
Yeah.
We're probably still 98-99% Windows XP.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, just like you said, you know, one of the things we look at is going to Windows 7, what is that going to give us from a business standpoint? You know, is that really going to make us more productive? And for the most part, that's hard to justify. But I just went through teaching most of my group, or a lot of my group, some Excel training. We're doing weekly Excel training. And through that Excel training, we found that we had people using Excel 2000.
The most recent one.
Yeah, Excel 2000, 2003. I think we had most people in 2003. I had 2010. And, you know, we did find that from a business case that for a lot of our staff, Excel 2010 does make sense.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we'll probably over time be upgrading some of those guys to Windows 7.
You'll also find, I think, some of the integration. I don't know if you guys are a SharePoint shop, but of course, SharePoint is tightly integrated. SharePoint 2010 is tightly integrated with Office 2010. And there's a lot of nice things that work between the two of those when you decide to integrate those. So that's kind of another reason to move to Office 2010. Plus, I think the UI just gets a lot better in 2010 than it's ever been. It's unified. It looks the same in all the apps. The apps work, I think, a lot better. I don't have as much problem moving folks. Do you guys use Microsoft Software Assurance for the way you purchase, or do you guys purchase each time you upgrade?
We purchase each time.
Oh, that makes sense. Okay.
Yeah. I will say that, you know, there is some nice things in Excel. If you're a Power Excel user, there's some nice things in Excel 2010 that make it worth the upgrade, especially if you're on Excel 2000. I'm sorry, Andrew?
It's got a lot better, hasn't it?
It has. It's gotten a lot better.
Yeah, especially data mining and whatnot.
Yeah, although if you push the limit on a number of rows, you better have a powerful PC.
Yeah, and you better be running 64-bit. I mean, you have to, and for some of the to take usage of the extended functionality that's in Excel.
Right.
You better have some good memory, and you want a pretty fast processor.
Absolutely.
It's a little mini database in some ways. You know that those Excel. I've watched these people build out these Excel apps, or what we call Excel data warehouses.
Yeah,
and it's pretty amazing. But
yeah
it's Mike, as you guys make that jump to Windows 7, you're going to incur those costs then as you make the upgrade. You'll have to move eventually, right? I mean, XP is 10 years old, right?
Yeah, we'll have to move eventually. But, you know, our ERP, our main accounting system, is, 11, 12 years old without much update since then.
Yeah.
So, you know, I guess our philosophy is if it works, you know, there's got to be a good reason to upgrade.
No, there's some good truth to that.
Right.
Absolutely.
True, true. Although Windows XP, I mean, we've only got, 3 years left? 3 years last. 3 years last Thursday for you guys and 3 years last Friday for me.
Have they really, is it really 3 more years of support on Windows XP? Yep.
Extended support end date is the 8th of April 2014.
Okay. That's ridiculous.
Before we move to the next version of Windows, one of the things we're doing is upgrading our internet connection, which for an office of 300 people was being run on a T1 line.
Oh.
A single T1 line.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember when T1 was all the rage. I mean, that wasn't – yeah. It's like when you had a T1, you had a pretty fast line.
I can tell you with 300 people using it, it is not very fast.
Not in today's modern internet world, no. It doesn't get you much anymore.
No.
That's for sure. Yeah. Well, guys, we've been going about an hour 15, and I think I will bring this thing to a close. Anybody else want to throw anything else in there before we wrap it up?
Well, I was just going to – you're talking about how you're extending Excel.
Yeah.
And how that's really – that it really is the starting point for the database, because after that, it was Microsoft Access, and that was your first flat database file format that was similar to using Excel and making spreadsheets. And that's obviously where SQL and your query languages come from. So that's cool. And also, I haven't really seen that many people or businesses, for that matter – bite the bullet for 2010. I've all seen either 03 or 07. Most commonly in the college universities, Office 07 has been all over the place. So I really haven't seen 010 in any educational institutions yet.
There's some slick stuff in 10 that I think makes it working, you know, moving up. If you are a big pivot table, you know, user, the slicer option is just really handy. So I don't know. Yeah. You have to look at it and see if it's something that you would use.
Yeah, it's a case. You know, although from a licensing standpoint, Mike, I mean, as Microsoft moves forward and they're getting better with more predictable upgrades, at least in the enterprise environment, it does kind of build the case for this software assurance, or whatever they call it these days, where you pay a little bit of maintenance each year and then you upgrade, you stay on the upgrade track, because, you know, Windows 8 is going to be public beta here later, maybe the end of the year or early next. And we'll be talking about, you know, a year from there, Windows 8 is out. And, you know, from an enterprise standpoint, I mean, yeah. You know where I'm going with that, right?
Yeah, and we do. We are looking at that.
Yeah.
The tech group doesn't report to me, though.
Yeah, I get you. I catch you there.
I think as a consumer, though, the life cycle is getting kind of scary at the moment. Like, at an enterprise and a business and an educator level, it's kind of scary too. But as an end consumer, if you're, you know, Joe off the street, and you look at the potential hardware cycle that sits in the background, behind this. I mean, you know, I'm running Windows 7 at the moment on a P4 3 gig processor with 4 gig of RAM, and that struggles. But right. I'm in no hurry because
that,
I use that machine mostly.
That's pretty old, right?
Yeah. And it is fairly old. But I run both my home servers on the same processor and the same spec box pretty much. But you look at, you know, if the hardware platform requirement keeps going up, you know, I know Moore's Law says that, you know, the speed doubles, the price halves, but with this day and age, you know, everything's becoming more expensive, and I think it's kind of daunting as an end consumer. I've still got friends out there running Windows 95 because they can't justify hardware cost.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
And Windows 95... But you know what? Windows 95 isn't that hard to support.
Yeah.
I think for the average user, there's got to be a good reason to, you know, to move up. I'm sure if I polled most of the people in my office at home, they're still running XP.
Yeah. No, you're right. You're right. Yeah. I asked that question as we were making the jump to Windows 7, and I said, so have you bought a Windows 7 PC yet? And it's been a year. And I bet only 15 or 20% have actually have a Windows 7 box at home.
Yeah, because I think for a lot of the average people, the only time they're going to upgrade the OS is when they physically buy a new machine.
Right, right.
Yeah, and that's it. That's an emotional attachment to cash.
Yeah.
And I mean, let's face it, everyone's emotionally attached to their cash.
Yeah, yeah, you're right there. And you know, I sometimes forget, much like I forget that you guys in Australia have capped data plans. I also forget that you know, I enjoy the upgrade process. And so, for me, I'm all over that. I'm like, why would you not want to go, you know, to Windows 7? Much like I moved to Vista pretty quickly, even though it struggled and it had its problems. It wasn't too bad for me. I forget there's others who want to just keep working with something that works.
Yeah, and it's funny, you know, I mean, the girl who sits across the partition from me at work, she got a brand spanking new Core i5 laptop a couple of weeks ago, and it came with a Vista image on it because that's our current mass deployment image, and all she wanted to know is, how do I get XP? But, you know, it's what she's comfortable with, it's what works for her, and I said, hey, why don't you go for Windows 7? It's just gone for major release in the company. No, don't want to know about it.
Yeah. Well, we found, though, that Andrew, in our enterprise, we found that most folks made the jump from XP to 7 with very few problems. You know, their outlook looked a little bit different, but they, within about 5 minutes, they were able to navigate, you know, through it and see the difference in the changes. Internet Explorer stayed exactly the same for the most part, so there was very few changes there. Start menu worked very similar. You know, once about an hour or two into it, I sat down with the group that I oversaw. I would sit down with each one of them individually and give them a 30-minute, you know, 30, 45-minute little primer to say, okay, here's – go here to do this and check this out. And overwhelmingly, they were like, oh, yeah, it's fine. I don't even notice anymore that I'm on XP or 7. It just works. The change is much different than it was, I think, when we went from Windows 2000 onto XP. That was a big change. I don't think XP to 7 is as big of a change.
I think you hit it there, Jim, when you said it just works, because most people aren't thinking about the OS. They're thinking about, what program do I use? Do I use Quicken? Right. Do I use, you know, what do I use? And I only care about that program. I don't care about the OS.
Right. Right.
And at least that's been what I run into.
Well, we've gotten very browser-centric as well, right? I mean, I think 80% of people's lives are now spent in the browser. Well, if you're not changing the browser and you're changing the OS underneath it, the adoption is very easy. Hey, just where do I go to click on, you know, to open my browser? And they know that environment. So, you know, that works real well.
Yeah, I think most people, and this is talking to my peers, they don't so much care what the operating system is as long as it doesn't impact on the performance of what they're trying to do.
Right, right.
So I think that was the biggest gripe that most of the people, particularly in the enterprise, had with Vista, is that Vista just had that – it seemed to have that extra layer of bloat that we were talking about before.
Right.
Whereas with 7, you know, you go from – if you go from XP to 7, your machine's faster. But if you go from Vista to 7, your machine's blindingly faster.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
big. And I think that's a significant difference.
My mother-in-law had a Dell with a Vista on it, and I took that off and put in Windows 7, and it made a huge difference.
Yeah, it really does. I mean, it almost gives the PC new life in some ways. Not every PC is architected that way, but many of them, if they were running Vista before, they'll run 7 better.
Yeah.
And I always tell people, oh, if you're on Vista, do the anytime upgrade or get upgraded, because you'll find better performance.
Now, if I can just teach her how to double click. Double click does not involve 7 clicks and a drag.
Yes. Yeah. Well, my mom, if it doesn't click, if it doesn't work the very first time, she thinks if she does it 100 more times, it'll work.
Yeah. Yeah. Every time I come over, there's desktop icons that have disappeared.
Yeah, that seems to go that way.
And double-clicking URLs. What is about double-clicking a URL in a web page?
You know, I'll be honest with you guys. I think my next PC for my parents is going to be an iPad. I mean, I think is with as little as she does on the PC, I think that's a pretty good for that generation. I think I'd have to test it, but I think that would work well for them. I think they'd get, you know, touching and moving, and they can't really delete anything, and she can check her email and be done.
Well, my mother-in-law is 85, so she's probably in a different group.
Well, my mom's 80, and I'd give her I think I'd give her an iPad. No, I think with an iPad with an hour or two of training, I think she'd actually have less problems with it. It's so much more intuitive. Mm-hmm. It has so much less things to go wrong with it, right? I mean, there's a PC is a power tool. An iPad is the screwdriver, right? I mean, she gets that. That's probably a bad analogy.
Yeah, the interesting thing for mine is my mum's 61, and she, in the last 5 years, five, 10 years, she's gone from not wanting to even know what a computer is to ringing me up and saying, "Hey, I just found out how to do blah on Windows 7. And I'm sitting there going, "Huh? You did what? you did what?"
Yeah.
And you know what? One of the things the other day, she found the problem recording wizard in the troubleshooting component in Windows 7.
Yeah.
And I mean, this is something that I've subsequently used at work, I hate to say.
Yeah.
And you know, how'd you find out about that? Oh, my mum told me. What's your mum do? Oh, she's retired and runs a bed and breakfast.
Yeah.
And you know, she rings me up and she goes, "Oh, I found this really cool thing." And you go into the troubleshooting and you click on this button and then you do what you want to do and then you press stop and you press save and you press send and you can send it to someone and they can play it back. And I'm like, really?
Yeah.
My mom's in her 60s and she's better in Photoshop than me. She can teach me.
Oh, that's fun.
Yeah.
Yeah, they find those niches, you know, and pretty soon they'll be making voice macros, you know.
Yep.
Christian,
yep,
chime. I was waiting for Christian to chime in on that one.
You know, that's my favorite.
All right, guys, let's wrap it up. I appreciate you guys being out there tonight and chatting through the show with me. Christian, you have a great trip to Argentina. And are you blogging your trip anywhere? Is there anywhere anybody can follow you as you're down there? Or you're completely cutting yourself off, right?
Well, I'm cutting myself off, but I have given the greater powers of Suzuki Land I've pretty much spent about 8 hours worth of development into getting a solution that they can all use. Achoo. Oh, there comes an achoo. If you go to buffalosuzukistrings.org, you'll be able to follow the tour blog as well as the photo gallery and possible video clips that will be uploaded as the tour goes on. So you'll be able to follow the actual blog, which is kind of getting itself together now, at buffalosuzukistrings.org/blog. The homepage has all the links for the tour ensemble, the photo gallery, and all the information's there. So
awesome. Well, Christian, have a good, safe trip while you're down there, and we'll expect you to come back and have a lot to report on 2 weeks from now.
Surely.
I'm very envious of you, Christian. I did Suzuki for, how old am I? 30-odd years, and oh, I never got a trip like that out of with the Suzuki group, so that's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah, so the technology of the trip to look out for is going to be the pin and chip. My dad went to probably 6 banks and couldn't find any pin and chip credit cards. It's a new standard they have for credit cards, and they don't swipe like we do, and it's some embedded chip, so I'm going to watch out for that.
Oh, we got them.
Yeah, we don't. You can't find them anywhere in the U.S. Couldn't really? Get them anywhere. I went to like 5 or 6 different banks. So they're gonna have to deal with the good old swipe.
Interesting.
We've had them for about 4 or 5 years now. Interesting. Yeah.
Well, you know, it's the U.S. We're ahead on some things, but not on everything. Mike, what do you got? So you got anything big coming up besides filing taxes this weekend? You got any big technology projects coming up over the next couple weeks?
Yeah, you know, the thing I mainly need to do is get my articles done.
do you owe Dave some articles for the Home Server Show?
You know, and Dave is so great. He has not bugged me at all about that. And I, you know, I feel really bad. I haven't got the second one done yet.
Yeah.
But it has been crazy at work. And we got, I think I mentioned before the thing started here, a board meeting coming up, and then an officer meeting after that. So hopefully I can squeeze something in there. I'm almost done.
Good. Good, yeah. Well, I'm sure he's looking forward to having. But you're right, Dave is very gracious about those.
He is.
Those articles. So I owe him some as well, and he's pretty good about that. So, Mike, thanks for coming on. We appreciate you coming out to the show tonight.
Sure, it's been a lot of fun.
Andrew, anything coming up for you technology-wise?
Technology front, I'm playing with my new Windows 2011 home server.
Oh, yeah.
Having a bit of a play with that. It seems to do media streaming a lot better to my TV, which I'm happy with.
Oh, that's good.
And it should, too.
I mean, there's reasons why that works better. So.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And it's, you know, I was watching an episode of Traffic Light last night, and it's seamless. It doesn't have the stutter problem that I occasionally got out of my old one, and it's nice. It's
excellent. Really nice.
Funny you should mention Traffic Light, huh, Jim?
Why?
Did you have a problem with the traffic light?
Did I?
A red light camera?
Do you know something I know? I don't know.
Maybe Let's not. See.
What is my wife? is she busting me? I did. Let's see. Is she talking about recently? She's in the chat. She loves to join us in the chat. And Yeah, I probably was texting. I did. We do have over by our Walmart in Iowa. We have a traffic light cam, and I did get busted. I was, you know, the light turned yellow and I sped up and then saw that it was a camera enforced, and that technology is pretty cool. I mean, they got the license plate. It's as clear as day. The little flash comes in and they send you, you know, they send you a bill for $100 or whatever it is. And
can you write them a letter in the US? In Australia, you write a letter and say, you know, I've had a perfect driving record, if you have. And, you know, it's been X number of years since my last demeanor, and, you know, given my current record, can you please give, you know,
oh,
show
really?
Some leniency? Yeah.
Oh, that would have been – I should have tried. I didn't give it a shot, so I should have tried. But I'll have to go find out. Maybe I just got a ticket in the mail. I better go upstairs and find out.
You can edit this part out if you want.
No, that's fine. I can get busted, and that's okay. Guys, thanks for coming out tonight, and everybody for – oh, she said no new ones. Whew. All right, so I'm off the hook. Guys, and if you're listening on the recorded show, make sure you can send your comments to us, podcast@theaverageguy.tv. Mike, we'll try and have you back on in the next couple weeks. And for everybody else, have a good night or a good day, depending on where you're at. Good night.
Night, guys. Good night.